steel, yeah.
And the steel that was laid between here and Chattanooga, the railroad was still active from here to Chena, and it came in that full route.
Yeah, come in the full route. It all come up the river.
Do you remember Charlie Joint?
Say, I want to tell you about Charlie Joint. He was an engineer. So this bridge used to go out every year. This is down here on Turner Street, you know. So Charlie went to the city and he said, I'll put you in a bridge, it won't go out. So they let him go to it. So he drove the piles, and so he built a bunch of bulkheads around the piers, you know, and filled them up with rocks. I think that was between 1910 and 12. So when the spring come, you know, and the ice started coming, I had backed up the ice, and of course they had to go out here and shoot the ice and bust it up so it go through the bridge. And so it jammed up here by the Independent Mill. And you know where the graveyard is? Was nothing but ice. And up here between 5th and 6th Street, it's still there, I think, yet. The river went down that street. So they got the ice to go on, and everything broke up, and everything went along fine. So then, about the 25th of June, we always used to, in the early days, we'd have the rains and the freshets, you know, the water. So pretty soon, the driftwood started coming down and landed against the bridge. And these loggers were all logging on the Chena, and their logs broke loose, and they come down against the bridge. And it's hell, you know, the bridge wouldn't move. And you wouldn't believe it, where we're sitting here tonight, there's a boat sunk underneath us. It jammed up here, or just above here, a little ways where the Fairview is, and it cut around this corner, and went around this corner there at 2nd and Cushman. And that's all been filled. And they had to blast the bridge out, or it's going to take the town. And in the meantime, I don't know how many of you people here tonight, the old Cap Langley, he owned the steamer Tana. And the steamer Tana later year left here, and they took it down on the Kuskokwim River. But with this jam, he was afraid to come up the Chena. So what did he do? But he come up noiseless slew and landed in the back of the USO. That was Charlie Joint. But he sure put in a bridge.
Anybody say?
Charlie happens when Conkin used to go to Chena on double ended, was there no train for a while between us and Chena?
Oh, I
came at 14 and I never went on the train to Chena. We always had it.
I know the train was, you see, it ended up after the U.S., they built the railroad in. But then when they connected the railroad, but then they cut out the Chena run.
Oh, that's good, because yeah. I was looking around.
And then you see...
I remember here, we went down to, in 1919 and 18, we were down at where Gilmore is and so on. I have pictures of the
locomotive there. But you take in the early days, you know, when Jodlin started this railroad, well, if we had a high water, he was out of business. But if they'd get stuck on Leo Bar or Home Bar, well, he was in business again. And it went along that way until this government railroad was taken over. And then they cut out the road to Chena.
Then this road, Charlie, left here and went out around the college and up Goldstream to the mouth of Gilmore Creek, came back up over and went up Fox Gulch to the top of the hill.
Now, take us
from there. Did it go down past Olness and out in the Chattanooga Valley to get to Chattanooga?
Well, not too far out, no.
How many conductors did you know on that railroad? How many wrecks did they have?
They never had no wrecks. The only time I ever seen they had a dog team to pull them. No, that railroad, engineer, his name was Jim Christensen, and then the fireman, his name was Swan Carlson, and then there was a conductor, was Jimmy Rodeball.
With Paul Waugh on it?
Yeah, old Paul Waugh. In the Fairbanks.
Captain Langley did what?
About the first theatrical troupe in the Fairbanks. From Dawson. Oh, that was way back. Gosh, I don't know when. I ain't got no diary.
When did you first come here,
Charlie?
When did you first get here in Fairbanks?
4.
1904?
Uh-huh.
Wonderful. And your father came to die here in
1896,
97.
Uh-huh. Or down in June before that.
I was talking to your sister the other day.
Who, Marion?
Uh-huh.
Well, she's born to die.
That's what she said.
Yeah,
when
I got...
she born?
97. 98.
Well, then,
were
you older than she is?
Oh, yeah. I had two sisters younger.
Well, you weren't born in Alaska then.
No. I'm a native son.
There was a... Well, shake hands, your native son.
In California?
Yes.
Where at?
San Francisco.
Oh, dear, well, I'm north of you. About writing. You know, I got quite a kick out of it. My dad, where we lived, was in a mining town that's down in Redding, about 50 miles. And there's gold up there too, you know, but he didn't think there's enough gold there, so he thought he had to come to Alaska. And I'm sure, thank God, he did. To get away from the heat and the rifle snakes.
To get back to steamboating, Charlie.
Yeah.
Didn't we have some boats wrecked between here and Nenana?
Well, no. There's no wreck. The only one was the time the Hungry Kid, when they built the railroad, and he took that motor ship, and George Coleman and that bunch was on it.
Tell us about it.
Are you going back to history again? The Hungry Kid, they used to be, you know, Hosey Ross, the Undertaker, and so forth here. Used to run an automobile between here and Fairbanks Creek they called the Thomas Flyer. I never heard of the automobile before or never heard of it afterwards. So this Hungry Kid, he used to hang around with the Malibu Kid. So he got this engine out of this Thomas Flyer and he built a launch and he was running it between here and Nenana. And I don't know, I think Holly Sterling's wife was on, his first wife. That Frank's young sister. And I think Coleman was on it, and I don't know who else. But this was a speedboat, and I think he hit the snag, and he just hung on to the snag, because they never found nothing that I heard of. And you know the Tana River is, it's full of silt. And I think it just sunk everything. Mm-hmm. And I was on a boat once and was going down the river. And this man fell off the boat. And there's so much silt in the river that he never came up. We never did find him. And the Tana River, it's a good one. One time I was going down, we'd taken a barge load of lumber from the Independent Mill, and this Dominion Commercial Company, they had two big boats. They called it the Minneapolis and the Julia B. And then they had a smaller boat, what they called the Tetman. So while the boats were down at St. Michael's, loading up the freight again, the big boat. This little boat, we went up here then and we loaded it up with lumber. So everything went fine, and when we hit the town of River, we had such a load to make the bends and everything, we had to back down to steer the boat. So when we got down here to Miami Hot Springs, we hit a bar. Here we was high and dry. So the captain says, we'll wait for, I don't know how many people here tonight, but his name was Kettleson, Cap Kettleson. So he says, we'll sit here and wait until a boat comes by, and then he says, we'll get off. So in about 48 hours, old Cannell started coming in again, and she cut us loose. And that was the year of the Ruby Strike. We was taking this load of lumber down to Ruby. But to just show you that Cannell River, she stretches, because anybody drops in there, it's good night.
To get back to railroading between here and Chattanooga, what did they use for fuel?
The wood burners.
Where did they get it?
Well, they cut wood along the, the mines have to get out here above 17 Gold Stream while the mines have cleaned out all the wood. So they had to pick it up on this end.
And haul it out there. And yeah. There was a lot of people making a living cutting wood.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. You know, when you think back, you go back into history and take the Indians along the Yukon and the Tama River. There was no poverty. They wasn't very sanitary, but them people could trap all winter long. In them days, if you caught a silver fox or a black fox, you were sure from $800 to $1,000. And the Indians, they were living good. They didn't ask for nothing, and they got along with the white people. There's no trouble at all. But then here comes your politicians. And a few of these Indians were half educated. They went to college. So to make their debut in Juneau, they wanted Indian vote. So what did they do? They passed a law down there to the legislature to let the Indians vote. Well, what did they do then? The Indians go in Second Avenue, take in all the bars and drink.
That was the end of the Indians.
That was the end of the Indians, yeah.
The good Indians.
Yeah, and then it went along, and after all of that, if you caught giving a drink to an Indian, why, it was a fine. It's against the law. And there was nobody monkeying with the Indians. The only one I know monkeyed with the Indians was some of these traders. They couldn't give them booze, but they give them vanilla extract or lemon extract. And then they could get their furs, see? And when you follow the law and then take it right up now to today, since we struck oil, the Indians won't last you. They even want my homestead out there, maybe. So, what are you going to do with them? We're waiting for Udall. You know that man, Udall?
I've heard of him.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's all we're waiting for. You know, I heard a good story. I don't know if people are going to like it or not.
Just tell it to me then.
Let's put it on tape.
But I don't know how many of you people remember, he was a traveling salesman and he used to come north every year. And he'd have, I think he was in National Grocery, and he's selling mistletoe hams and so forth. So the first boat would come into Nome. Well, you'd always bring a bag of candy along for the kids. And of course, it's all lined up this day. The Eskimos and the Indian kids are on this end, and the white kids are on the other end. And he started, well, this is after 4 or 5 trips, he started passing out this candy. And so when he hit this bunch of Eskimo kids, becomes a little blonde fellow. And he says, you're not Eskimo. He says, you get down there in the lane and get with them white kids. He says, no. He says, nothing doing. He says, I'm part missionary.
Part missionary. Can you tell us anything about the Ruby strike? You were on this boatload of lumber when Ruby was struck.
Yeah, I went down there, but everything was all taken up. There was no use to stay there. I left one time in the Live and Good strike, I think that was in 13. And I don't know how many people here remember old Billy Butler. He was a marshal here at one time. So Jack Allman, he was Tom Markham's son-in-law, you know. So he hit out about 2 days ahead of Billy and I, and he said, I'll get over there and get located. And he says, when you catch up, well, he said, come on in. And so this Billy Butler and I, and we started out, and it was in April, you know, and the water just started to run. So when we got to Washington Creek, we stopped there overnight. So then the next morning we was getting ready to start out, and I don't know what happened to Billy, but his feet were all blistered. And so I said, well, Billy, I'll go on and I'll be over there at Jack Allman's. And if you catch up, why, come on over. So I started out and I was all alone.
How many horses?
No horses, no. Walking. Walk. I put a pack on my back. So, gosh, when I got up to the top of Washington Dome, who met me? Who do you think? 2 bears. I didn't have a gun or a goddamn thing. So I just stopped still, and they come up on their haunches. And they did that for about 5 minutes. And I was so scared, I couldn't move. I couldn't say a word. I just kept a looking at them. Finally, they put their feet down. They started up the hill. So I waited until they got about 200 yards.
You put your feet down, huh?
Right, I was able to move again. Oh, I'll tell you, boy, that was a day.
Charlie Allman was his stepson, not his son-in-law.
Hmm?
Allman was his stepson.
Yeah, sure, Tom's stepson. Oh, he was a fine fellow, Jack.
What kind of rolling stock did they have on this Chattanooga Railroad? I have never seen a picture of a passenger coach.
Yeah, they have. They got a picture of a dog team pulling them out here at Olvis. Old 51.
I've seen pictures of flat cars with a bunch of seats crossways on them and 40 or 50 people sitting and coming into Fairbanks for a 4th of July celebration.
4th of July, yeah.
So I assumed they didn't have any passenger cars.
Not at first, no. They just had the passenger cars, but later on they had the passenger cars. They had 2 coaches.
When I first came here, it was triple track from here out to College. The center rail was for the narrow gauge and the other was standard for Alaska.
Yeah.
Did they have a turntable here or a Y? Did the Loki back up to Chattanooga and come ahead, or did they have a Y out there?
They had a Y here. And then they had a Y at Chattanooga. They even had a Y at Gilmore. Mm-hmm. Because I remember we used to stop there and we put all the water into where we could.
That's just what I was leading up to. How many water towers along the way?
Well, that was on Gold Stream there, just so when you get above Fox, there was a water tower, and then there was another one at Gilmore. And then I had another one up at Ridgetop.
Ridgetop?
Yeah.
That's the top of Fox Gulch.
Yeah, before you drop over into the...
Then it went down by Oldness?
Yeah.
And around in the...
Down vault.
Down vault?
No, it was on this side of vault. The boat was on the other side of the valley, you see, Balton Treasure.
But it went down Fort Olness and around.
Come into Dome, the lower part of Dome. Oh, it must have been about 56 or 10 below Dome, because you know Walter Fisher, that was quite a ways down to his place, to the Niggerhead Association. And they followed around Dome and come into the El Dorado there. Heard Mrs. Rust.
You're not here tonight.
Her and Jesse used to be mining on El Dorado. And then they followed along, but it was quite a ways up from the Chattanooga, because I remember Walter Fisher. He had the Niggerhead Association. Mm-hmm. And he was running 150 men with a wheelbarrow. Yeah, I'll tell you another bear story. Walter, you know, he's... where's Grace, Fisher's sister? And you know, Grace is still here?
No, Grace is still here.
So Walter, every 2 weeks, he'd have to clean up and bring the gold dust in, you know. So it's taking about 3 or 4 days to get his business done. And so when he got his business all done and everything, why, of course, he'd always have to take a little medicine along for the boys to recuperate, see. So this day, he got off the train there at Olness and hit down for the Niggerhead. And when he got about 100 feet from the cabin, he heard he had one of these old Edison phonographs with a round disc. So he thought the boys were all there waiting for him. So when he opened the door, here was a bear playing the phonograph. He beats it out and he goes down to the cook shack and tells the boys there's a bear in my cabin. So they come up and they got the bear out. I guess they shot him. Well, that was really so. The bear was playing the old phonograph.
He must have been a musical bear.
Yeah. Well, you know, one time out here, you like to hear bear stories. I was out here on Steamboat Pup. It comes into Pedro, and I was mining up there. There's a fellow by the name of Wooden, and Eddie Austin, and myself, and we were partners. And of course, them days, there's no transportation, you had to walk. So Eddie and Wooden wanted to come into Fairbanks, and they left me all alone, and of course, I couldn't do nothing. So, well, it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I thought I'd go up and pick a few blueberries. So I was picking these blueberries, and all of a sudden I heard a noise, and I looked up, and here was a mother bear. And here was two cubs. And she raised up, and she started towards me. So I was only about 600 feet from the cabin. And it was a lucky day for me, because I started running, the bear started after me. I look around, she's about 8 feet behind me, but I happened to leave the door open to the cabin. And just when I got to the cabin door, I stepped aside and she stumbled and she fell in. I closed the door. I said, there's only one window in the cabin, see? I know she wouldn't stay away from the cubs very long. So there's a pick there, and you know how the cabins were built in the early days. They were staggered on the corner of the logs. So I threw the pick up on the roof, and I went down the corner, and I climbed up on the roof, and I knew darn well she's going to come out the window, you see. So I stood there with this pick, and she was so god darn smart that she opened the door and come out.
She left you with poor pickings, huh?
I was up there, and she raised up and don't run away. pick is raised up, you know. So I come over and I was holding this pick, and she changed her mind. Yeah, I hit her right square in the head. Yeah. But I talk about bears. Of course, here a few years ago, I don't know what happened to these bears. But in 2 hours' time, I've counted 11 bears.
Where?
Huh?
Where?
Down here on this side of Dunbar's. Yeah, when we was working on the railroad, when we get off ship after 6 o'clock, and we'd, you know, nothing to do, we'd take a walk up the track. In 2 hours' time, we could count 11 bears.
You ever cook? Have bear meat?
Huh? I tried it once. Yeah. Yeah, I ate bear meat. Bear meat is just like pork when it's a little bit darker.
I found it very good.
Hmm?
I found black bear very good.
Oh yeah, very. You get a fat one and it's really nice meat.
I have a question, Charlie. Back in the early days, was there a riverboat sunk here in Fairbanks by an ice jam?
By accident?
No, by an ice jam, and a friend here was frozen.
Yeah.
It was the year of the fire, wasn't it?
Lottie Tablet.
And then later on, it burned to the water.
Yeah, it was, I used to herd for all these companies in the early days, you know, cattle. And the Pacific Coast Storage Company is the first cold storage book ever come into Fairbanks. And it's tied right there where the old Nordale and the Prairie View Hotel was. The boat's name was the Lottie Tablet. And then they hung her up there all winter because she was loaded with meat. And when the ice broke up that spring, why it sunk her there. But they raised her though. But right here, under this building, I don't know whether it's the Isabella or the Luella. They sunk it here.
Being an old timer, there's the ribs of an old boat across from Rika Wallens in the mouth of that slough. Can you recall the name of it?
No. See, the boat, whatever, went up the Chena. The farthest up the Chena was Jenny M.
That's where that slough got its name?
Yeah, that's where it got its name. They went that far.
Well now, Charlie, you were farming here in the early days. Swing over and give us all the history you can on the beginning of and up through building a mill here and grinding and making their own flour. Start at the beginning and tell us.
Where's Bob Bloom?
Who pushed it?
You remember Bob Bloom?
Yes, we all did.
One pushed. Well, the way this stuff all started, you take over where Bentley is now, a man by the name of Bill Young, he filed on the first homestead. And that was in 1904. But then I started off, but what started farming here was these teamsters. They all had the horses. And they had to buy all their feed through the NC company. So, well, you take this farmer's loop road and around this way, there wasn't nothing there but birch. And when they cleared off the land, then they cleared up a little land and they started throwing a little grain. And that started your farm. And so when they got more land cleared, then they put in a flouring mill here. And they raise their wheat out there. You take on the hillside, you can raise good wheat. And they started the flour mill, and they had good flour. I'll give them credit for that. But it's too bad to think that of all the farming we had here, Darien, you know, I felt kind of bad because I had to go out of business. But when I think that the Golden Heart had to go out of business, and from what I hear right now, is Matanuska is going to go out of business. You can't be little, you have to be big. And when you get big, then you could get subsidized. You see?
But how long did this flour mill operate?
Oh, it operated for quite a few years. It operated until it burnt down.
Yeah, I was here when it burnt down. I witnessed it burn down.
Mm-hmm.
But I wondered how long it operated. Did they have a name for their flour, a trade name?
Well, what they called it.
Yeah, I was here when it burnt down. I witnessed it burn down.
Mm-hmm.
But I wondered how long it operated. Did they have a name for their flour, a trade name?
Well, what they called it. Well, the Golden Heart, ain't it? Yeah.
I bought some when I came to Fairbanks. Golden Heart.
You know, there was Bob Bloom and old Harry Badger. McIntyre out here. Oh, quite a few of them were just interested.
In the early 30s, I'd like to record this, that George Gasser and I figured out that 600 acres would have supplied all Alaska with flour. Mm-hmm. 600 acres of wheat.
Yeah.
So this flour mill only operated a few weeks a year.
Well, just in after the fall, during the winter, after the harvest.
On an average yield, it would have supplied the whole
interior.
All of Alaska, not only interior, but southeastern Alaska. And it is such a good wheat country this way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'll tell you, I've grown grain down the flats, and I've grown grain on the hill, and I've trained different grains from as far over north as Montana. That's just the Dakota country we are up there around Havre. And I've tried all the different seeds. And up on the hillside, you can grow with a hard one. They can try and grow in the flats here. And your hearts are hollow. There's too much moisture. But on the hillside, you're the ripened. And I can't understand it today why we haven't got a flour mill. And another thing I can't understand today, that we're paying all this water freight and everybody likes it, that we haven't got a brewery.
Well, the brewery you did have here, did they use local wheat?
No.
Barley? Grain?
You have to use barley.
But they ship that all in?
Yeah. But now, you think after Prohibition was over, they started a brewery up here where the old Bartell Brewery was, and then they started this old Pioneer Brewery. But you wouldn't believe it, in the early days, when they had to ship Budweiser and these stateside beers, that this man, Bartell Brewery Company, put out such a good beer, and Anheuser-Busch and them wasn't in it. They'd all buy this Fairbanks beer.
Did you know anybody up at Bartell's at that time?
Oh, I knew the Bartell family, and there's some of them here yet. But their names, shucks.
Well, don't tell me that you knew a man by the name of George Utterback.
Utterback, yeah. I know George Utterback, and they worked, and I know George Weber, he worked for him. And what's this fellow over here on the island? He made these chimney blocks.
Oh.
Don has got a son by the name of Don.
Well, George Utterback was my uncle.
No.
George?
Yeah. Now you're talking. Yeah, a thief family. They worked for old Bartell.
George Utterback was my uncle, and he was a bartender in Dawson, I guess, during the early days. And then he came over here and talked about that bottling works.
Yeah.
And then he talked about walking from here to Valdez to get out of the country.
Yeah, but he didn't work for Bartell. He worked for that brewery down here in the lower end of town. I know, I'm sure.
Worked the rivers in the brewery business?
Well, he took over it after it went again.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, now, Charlie, I'd like to swing over to Birds.
Birds.
Now, you started a farm out here, and when you got a little acreage cleared, some ducks must have started landing there. Take us through the history of the birds landing out on your farm. Now, when did they start?
You know, I just been thinking, when you bring up about birds, why, we ought to have a little story about that.
That's what we want.
You ever hear about the swallows?
Swallows?
Yeah, we ought to go down to the bird store and have a swallow.
Now listen, you're getting too sharp for me altogether. Anybody got a swallow?
But, yeah, you take about birds now. In the early days, there wasn't enough birds went through here.
That's what I'm wondering. When did they get started?
And way back in 1905 and 64, and then we used to go out to the Tama River to get our birds. And then Hickley, he started a dairy there in 1910. And there'd be a few birds come in there. There wasn't very many, maybe a flight of a couple hundred. So then when I took over the dairy, instead of cleaning the barn once a year, you know, I used to clean it every day. And of course, them days, we raised lots of oats and barley. And the sweet ones, we throw in the spreader and we take it out and put it on the field. Well, then the birds started coming, and every year they keep increasing.
Then you maintain they came because they was feed there, not because there was bare ground.
No, because of, you remember Bernie Carr?
Yeah.
Well, right down there next to the fairground, when was that, about 1908, I think, we went down there. While they took up that farm, there was a couple of spots just inside of the fairground. A fellow by the name of Murray, he took it up because he could cut the grass for his horses. And so Bernie and I, we used to go out there duck hunting in the spring of the year. And there was no flight at all, hardly. But every year after I got the dairy going there after 30, they keep it coming more and more every year. And, I've been 10 or 12,000 of them out there, you know. And so one year I used to raise from 500 to 700 tons of potatoes. Of course, you'd have these cold potatoes. And I'd run them out in the spreader and put them on the snow. And I figure as soon as the snow's gone, I'd plow them under. But God darn goose and ducks would beat me to them.
They'd eat them.
When I went out there to plow them under, there wasn't a spud.
What kind of birds?
All the ducks and geese. Cranes.
And they ate potatoes.
Oh, clean them right up. I had potatoes there, a way to pound them. They'd eat them, pick at them, clean them up. Well, I'll tell you, when you lived amongst birds, like I have for ever since 28, and watch them and see how they live. And I've just been watching these little swallows. It's hard to believe it, but they come clear from Africa.
How do you
Huh? Because they followed them. Here a fellow come in about 3 weeks ago from Frisco, and he said they just come into San Francisco. So you go out here and watch these swallows and watch nature and watch them how they live.
Yeah, the
turn
comes from South America.
Hmm? Yeah, they come across, you know, from Africa and hit across the end there and come on over in South America, and they come clear up to here. Mm-hmm. Well, you get these books and read up now. Just like I had a little man working for me, he was a Finn. And he studied up on birds, and he had read books, and he was always telling me about this little bird with a hitchhike. And I couldn't believe it, you know. And so there's a family here, their names were Dempseys. So I had this kid on a tractor this day, and then as I was using a binder, binding grain, and the tractor broke down, and we was working on it. It was in September, and the cranes were just ready to pull out. And they swung right around us, and we could hear this whistling noise. So we took a look, and here this little bird was sitting on the crane's back. Now, believe it or not.
Well, pardon me, but were there many swans in this country at any time?
Yeah, in the early days. Where you take out on the Tama River.
They seldom landed on your farm, though.
The most I ever seen was six.
Six.
And the funny part of it is, I haven't seen a swan for 10 years. And here now they're back, two of them.
Is that what they call a whistling?
Hmm?
Whistling
crane? Yeah, they're a crane. They ain't really a swan. Some of them call them a whooping, and others call them a whistling.
Yeah. But they're white like a swan.
Oh yeah, they're just white. They're out there. The girl, she's going to university, and I guess she's studying birds too, and she come out there the other day, and she's seeing them. She's staying out there at Joe Lawler's.
Where are the swans now? Hmm? Where are the swans?
They're right in back of our place over there in the water. You take along there now, you don't see no birds at all. But between our place and the hill, it's just full of sprigs and teals and mallards and butterballs. Hmm. Hey, you know, these drakes, they're pretty wise. After they get through mating and get the little hens sitting on the eggs, they go around and they sit around. And today I had a laugh just when I was coming into town in the afternoon. I hear 50 of these old drakes flew over. Now, they don't do a darn thing, and they turn it all over to the old girls.
They don't stay there, do they?
The drakes? Oh yeah, they stay here quite a while. They ought to put a law in so we can go out and shoot them.
Well, they don't stick around all summer, though.
Oh, well, they're here for another month anyway. Yeah, I see them here that long.
Well, wasn't there a steamer here called the Porteous Beware?
The old Weir, the steamer? Yeah, yes, sure. That's the O-N-A-T boat.
Did it come to Fairbanks?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You see, the N-A-T and T Company, you had the Weir.
I recorded on the tape that I made about a month ago. I had five or six little historical items, and I recorded them on the last of it, and one of them was the history of the old N.C. Firehouse. And it mentions that it had a whistle on it for it blew 8 times a day, telling the people of Fairbanks the time of day. And it It was shipped up from Seattle, and they didn't like it, and they took the whistle off the wear and put up there. And it was there from 1905 till
where, huh?
Till 1952.
I don't know if any of you people have ever been down to St. Michael.
What's down there?
That was a graveyard for the boats.
Tell us about it.
Huh? Well, they had, between Dawson and Palinor, or between Dawson and St. Michael's, they had the three old burners, the Susie, the Louise, and the Sarah. And the biggest river boat in the world is down at St. Michael's. I don't know what's left of her. I haven't been down there since 1917. Get enough freight for her.
Well, she was there in 31 when I walked all over the whole bunch of them.
Well, W.H. Heisen.
The beach for a mile was lined up with beautiful boats that only made one or two trips and then were beached. And they were sitting there on their blocking with the most beautiful scallop and woodwork around their first and second deck.
Was the machinery out or was it in?
No, just ready to go.
I know they oiled and greased and did everything to the machinery. But that Will H. Isom, I think she made one trip to Dawson.
Well, I'll break your heart because after the war, somebody went in there and burned them all up just for scrap iron.
No.
That whole row of them. Beautiful boats. They tell me some only made one and two trips.
Is that so? They burned them up.
Most beautiful.
There's another bunch up the Yukon, up in some tree up there. I forget the place, but there's a whole bunch of them up there too.
On the Yukon?
Yeah.
In Canada?
No,
down the lower Yukon.
No, they ain't done until you get to St. Michael.
No, I saw them there.
When?
Before you get to St. Michael.
When?
Like Charlie, so long ago I can't remember.
I boated every inch of it from Ketchikan to Nome, and I didn't see him only on the beach.
On the beach
in St. Michael.
Because
Andreas.
What the river where the Catholic mission is? No, there ain't no boats up there. There wasn't when I was there in 19.
Last time, all the way. Sometime in the
20s. Who's the woman
with Eva? Eva?
Wendy Jones. And I wrote a book about Sidney Lawrence. And a couple of years ago, I autographed some books for a young lady who was here. What is your name, dear? Yes, for Mrs. Matlock. At the, your wonderful bookstore,
Adler's.
Oh, Adler's, yeah.
And now I'm writing another book, and I'm so glad to meet you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cassidy?
Jim Cassidy.
Because they told me at the library about your tapes. I'm writing a book called First Ladies of Alaska, and I need your help because I don't know some of the First Ladies of Alaska. I'm beginning with the governor's wife, the Russian governor's wife, way back in 1795 with Baranov's wife, the Kadansky princess. And then I come up, of course, to Mrs. Hickel. And they're not all first ladies. I'm using colorful characters and people that have helped Alaska. And some of them are not great. Some of them were on the Yukon. And I would love to talk with you some more sometime.
Yeah, Mrs. Pullen.
Yes, Harriet Pullen and Alaska Nellie and of course our friend over there.
Nellie Neal.
Yes, Nellie Neal Line.
But have you got Fanny Quigley?
No.
Well, you missed the best one of all.
Why don't you write it for
Fanny?
Me? Listen, because I'm taking other people's stories included in the book as well as Wendy Jones. I have articles you know, that Herb Hilscher wrote a wonderful one about Mopulin. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Patty's son, Stanton Patty, wrote a marvelous one about Eva. And I asked him tonight if I could use part of it, and he said yes. Because I think it's much more authentic if the people who know them write it rather than me. That, for instance, I'm using the original letters that are the wonderful missionary, the very first woman to come to Wrangell. Her name was Amanda McFarland for the Presbyterian Church. She came with Sheldon Jackson in 1877 and lived in the wilderness all by herself. And I'm using her original letters that she wrote back to Sheldon Jackson telling all her troubles. So that if you people have any suggestions, I would be glad to know about them. Because, of course, I know you people are much more historical than we are. You're older than the Anchorage, you know. They sometimes make fun of us and say we're not even Alaskans. But I've lived there 22 years, and I can remember when I first went to Spinard. My husband had a homestead, and there were only four houses in all Spinard, and now there are more people there than in all Anchorage. So we're gradually growing up, but I would love to know whom you consider. I do have a story about Isabel Barnett, so I was real thrilled to have you tell about the boat tonight.
About the boat?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I knew Cap Barnett and his wife, and they talked about this house down here where Cap Barnett built.
Yes.
And then his brother-in-law lived there with him, MacArthur.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, Robert D. Armand wrote the story that I have about Mrs. Barnett. It was published in the Alaska Sportsman. And I combed the Alaska Sportsman, and I have a very interesting story about, well, he was a Russian priest, and his wife was a beautiful blonde. It was told by a little girl, and her name was Vera Ivanov, and they lived on an island down near in Southeastern. It's a charming story.
There's quite an Ivanov family in Nome that taught school at St. Michael on Nunavak Island. And
Emily Brown?
There.
Emily Ivanov Brown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well.
Now, I'd like to bring up another matter. You speak of researching the Alaska Sportsman. And I just learned tonight from Mr. Reed that the Armin will no longer be putting in those very marvelous historical stories that he always had three or four pages of.
What's he going to do?
You know?
Penning is the editor now. He's going on for more.
And he don't think that type of write-up should be in that magazine, so I'm going to plead with you to have your society in it. Anchorage, and we up here will do the same and write and complain that we want more of the Armand's historical articles.
Good.
Remember that.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you. I enjoyed
thank you.
Meeting
We're
you.
We're very happy to have you.
I'll tell a tale about Anchorage if you want me to.
Uh-huh.
29, I've accumulated about...
Come over here where we can get it.
No, I'm going
come on
here.
Come
I don't
know. Call it up to date.
Don't forget I'd like to hear some of your things. Did I
sometimes? Well, I'm turning them over to the new president for a short
time.
Oh, you mean my tape?
Well, I don't know. These pioneers tape.
Tell us your angry story.
Well, I was going to tell it to the ladies.
Well, tell it in front of the mic.
I was... 28, I went down to, I had accumulated about $10,000, which was quite a stunt in those days. I went down to Anchorage. I always thought Anchorage was...
What's your name, sir?
Irving Reed.
Irving Wood Reed. Nice to meet you.
I'd always thought that Anchorage was very strategically located for the big city.
Uh-huh.
So I went down there, and all the stores but one were empty. Most of the windows were broken out in the buildings, and the wooden sidewalks had all been, half of the planks were broken in them, I had just sold a house in Nome, six-room house with a doghouse, for $75, completely furnished. So I said, look, here's another city that's, here's another, just another city that's gone to pieces, that's just going to be dead. So we went outside and spent the $10,000.
And you didn't buy this wonderful...
Didn't buy a thing I could have bought. The whole half the town.
We're all in the same boat.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, for record purposes, that was Mr. Reed and Mrs. Jones. Bankers.
Hey, Mr. Reed, you ought to be able to tell about Mrs. Ford. She was a nice girl.
Yes, she had the, it was a under a different name, ma'am. So she was running under a different name.
Did he hold her for it?